Welcome to Roundtable Talk, a podcast about longevity, senior services marketing, and the quality of life as one ages. Roundtable Talk is brought to you by Pavone Group and Varsity, a senior services agency focused on helping clients win the mature market. If you like the fresh perspectives we deliver in each episode, please give Roundtable Talk a 5-star review on the podcast service of your choice.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Varsity's Roundtable Talk. I'm Derek Dunham, and today's guest is Marvell Adams, Jr. Marvell is a respected leader in aging services with more than 20 years of experience from nursing home administrator to CEO. He's the co-founder of the Longevity and Inclusion Alliance Fellows Program and the founder of W. Lawson, a consulting firm focused on equity, inclusion, and belonging. Marvell, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Derek. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I always enjoy our conversations. But so first, tell us a little about the Longevity and Inclusion Alliance Fellows Program. What does it do and what inspired you to create it?
Yeah. So the purpose of the Longevity Inclusion Alliance and its fellow program is really to bring together leaders throughout organizations in aging and human services to really come together to not only from a camaraderie standpoint, but to ideate on how can we be more inclusive within our communities. You know, the diversity within our country and throughout the world is changing pretty rapidly. And when it comes to older adults, that is also the case. And so really the mission of that is to provide leaders throughout our space the support, the courage, and the guidance to lead more inclusively. And part of that comes from really gaining the courage to be able to take that first step. And so the Fellows Program is an immersive, all virtual series of 5 sessions that leaders come together that are facilitated by myself and my co-founder, Sarah Moore. And really, our objective is to provide a safe space for people to really not only be vulnerable, but to learn and grow about being more inclusive and how to really create communities of inclusion and belonging. And so, you know, the genesis of it was just finding that in our space, there wasn't as much of an opportunity to have the space to be able to talk about issues around equity and inclusion, and also having the guidance and support to do something about it and take some action forward. And so we've been just really proud to not only have this program going on for the last couple of years or so, but we're just getting ready to launch our 4th cohort, our Delta cohort, as we refer to it, on July 10th. And so a lot of great momentum.
Wonderful. Well, the structure, as you mentioned, is really intentional. 5 clear steps that take participants on a journey from self-reflection to leadership. How did you develop the 5-step program? And are there any of the steps that are more important than others? Or more important is probably the wrong way to put it, but that might stand out or mm-hmm. are critical in some way?
Yeah, so great question. So, you know, the self-reflection piece is really a core part throughout the program. And much of it really is from my experience and Sarah's experience with programs of this type. And so I was formerly a coach for the Leading Age National Academy, as well as a part of the design team and coach for the Kindle Leadership Academy when I was with the Kindle Corporation. And so a lot of the experience and really the knowledge I gained from some great mentors in Lynn Giacobbe, the CEO of Kindle at Home, and Judy Soren Brown, who is the facilitator and mastermind behind the Leading Age Leadership Academy. And so that really was the genesis for thinking about this, but also just recognizing that each of those steps that we lay out there really have to do about not necessarily just learning about inclusion and belonging. You know, you can Google a lot of stuff and learn a lot of things. You can chat GPT a lot of things and learn a lot of things. But this really is purposely a space for people to be posed with questions that allow them to kind of look inwardly. Because in each of these journeys, they are unique to the individual. You know, folks that may be coming to us, they may be, 30 years working in a retirement community as a manager. They may be a new CEO. They might be a consultant. They may be the founder of an age tech startup that folks focuses, you know, in our space. But really, the end of the day, the binding tie is each individual wanting to challenge their own kind of preconceived notions about what inclusion and belonging may be, and really kind of push the envelope on how we can be more inclusively. And so I've seen that manifest itself in the ways of having a cohort where you've got architects and CEOs of providers, as well as marketing experts, come together offline and say, hey, you know, I think we have a commonality in the sense of how we see community being built, and then having really great business relationships come out of that, and knowing that each of them have, you know, an inclusion and belonging as a center of their thinking. And so for us, it's really about providing not just some sort of finite program, but more so the start of a journey that really is for everyone to carry forth for their own selves and organization.
That's great. You know, you'd reference, you can Google it, or now people are using ChatGPT for, mm-hmm. You know, in that place. How do you define, perhaps it might be the same or different from what we might find from a Google search, diversity, inclusion, or diversity, equity, inclusion, justice, belonging, those kinds of things. You don't have to go through each one necessarily, but, you know, describe how you define it and what you are looking, what impact you're looking to make in that overall subject or ecosystem.
Yeah. So, you know, I like to talk about it in really kind of, you know, simple terms. And many times it comes down to a person's feeling, right? And so when you talk about inclusion, I feel inclusion is a feeling. You know, if you ask someone, do you feel included? There usually is not a set of metrics that if you meet these metrics, then that person's automatically included. It really does come from a feeling, and that feeling can be nurtured, that feeling can be fostered. But at the end of the day, it's an organization's ability to really give a safe space for people to be themselves and feel included as their whole selves.
That's a great point.
When we talk about equity, I really like to talk about, outcomes. And when you're looking at an organization that truly is striving to be equitable, you're talking about looking at the metrics in your organization that are saying, okay, if we have, 13 staff members and we're recognizing that each of them have, you know, different backgrounds, different skill sets, different strengths, different opportunities and challenges for growth, how are we creating an environment in which they can equitably engage and thrive within the workplace, but also being treated fairly and having the same access to benefits, to information, and to, you know, upward mobility. And so when I talk about equity, we really are talking about what are the outcomes that are showing that this is a workplace or quite frankly, a community in which I'm living, where each individual as their whole self, not hiding a part of themselves, you know, but their whole selves being able to have a chance to have an equitable treatment within the organization and equitably, you know, engage, which is, you know, a really important part of it, because many times you can feel included within an organization, but still have a disparate outcome when it comes to you being treated, you know, equitably within the organization. And then lastly, what I'll, you know, say, Derek, is that when it comes to diversity, I say this really distinctly because it may not be in the literature, so it's really my opinion, but I really feel that diversity is a choice. And I say it that way because you can look at and making your organization more accessible, meaning that when a resident or a staff member or a board member, anyone comes into the organization, they are able to access the building itself, benefits, the infrastructure organization, physical as well as other aspects of the organization, that it's accessible to them, you know, and there may be an opportunity for feeling inclusion and being a sense of belonging. But at the end of the day, you can do everything right, but if someone in a position of power or leadership does not make the courageous step to make the community more diverse by looking at their hiring practices, by ensuring that they have diversity amongst their vendors that are serving the organization, that they're making sure that residents see themselves as being a part of the community, no matter what their walk of life might be, that staff feel that you know, they are represented throughout the organization, not just as staff members being represented at the CNA level, but as the nurse manager, as the supervisor, as the CEO, and everything in between, you know, unless those decisions are made courageously, diversity may not show up. And so in my mind, diversity really is a choice. And it's those choices you make at every single step of the way, whether it's looking for a new architectural firm and really asking the questions of, you know, tell me about the things you've done that have made communities more inclusive through design aspect, or looking for someone that's helping on the marketing side, or anyone just in dining services, understanding that there always can and should be, you know, a question about how are we being more inclusive. And those questions then lead to the opportunity to actually be more diverse.
Thank you for that. And I love how you said make decisions courageously. I think that's so important. And, you know, being willing to do that, I think, is critical for any organization that's going to be, you know, progressive and hopefully, you know, on the right side of where we're going. So now what's been the most rewarding, getting back to the Alliance, or surprising outcome from the program, the most rewarding or surprising outcome?
Gosh, you know, two things I would say is, one, I was speaking with Erica Thrash-Saul. I know she won't mind sharing this anecdote. So she's the CEO of Horizon House out west in Seattle. And she was a part of our first cohort of individuals. Afterwards, I'd given her a call just to catch up and provide ongoing support, but also just to talk about, you know, the upcoming next cohort. And she says, Marvell, the thing that really stood out for me is that, you know, she did the cohort, and then we host an annual retreat where we invite previous fellows as well as new and current fellows to come together. And she said, you know, I met an individual. I met Emily Pearson Brown, who is from Perkins Eastman as an architect. And she said, you know, what I loved about it is that I understood that they got it. And it wasn't that they understood the entire world of DEI. It wasn't that Erica was saying she understood the entire world of what needed to happen in her community to be more inclusive. But she did understand that they both were committed to doing the work, which really, you know, 9 times out of 10, that's what we're really talking about. You know, we're not talking about someone showing up on day one knowing every single aspect of how to make a community more inclusive and more diverse. What we are talking about is really doing the work that it takes to make those outcomes really demonstrated. And so, you know, for Erica to point out that if not for, you know, the Longevity Inclusion Alliance, she may not have seen these people in a light that would have had her say, aha, I really want to work with them because they really do get it. And so that's one thing I would offer to you. But the second, you know, I would say is that we had one cohort member who's a CEO of a retirement community. He reached out and he said, you know, Marvell, I was taken aback by a staff member that approached me. The person was of Hispanic or Latin background, and they were a housekeeper. And there'd been these reports, at least whether true or not, of immigration customs enforcement going on to a retirement community campus, you know, to do an enforcement. And, you know, he said, and he was in tears. He said, you know, I was asked the question about what I would do or what would happen if somebody showed up, you know, at the front of the community, the entrance, and I didn't have an answer. And he said, you know, and it dawned upon me that, like, you know, what I'm seeing in the news is not just in this other world. It's right here and right now every single day. And from a, you know, rubber meets road perspective, the thousands of staff members, you know, across the country, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands that are supporting individuals and community as they age and live, you know, they are the individuals that perhaps are being marginalized, or they're the individuals that are perhaps being threatened, and understanding that, like, as a leader, you really have to step up, because if they don't feel safe coming into work, they're not going to come into work. And we all know nowadays is that, you know, the value proposition is understanding that every single staff member that joins our team, we want to retain the best and the brightest. And in order to do that, they have to feel safe, they have to be rewarded, and they have to understand that the organization has their back. And so when that kind of eureka came to him, even though he understood it intuitively, you know, the fact that a staff member would ask, what are you going to do? He decided, I got to always have an answer for that. Because if staff can't feel safe coming into the organization in a whole host of ways, then we really have lost the battle already for retaining the best talent.
Great point. Yeah, that's a powerful story. But now, so where do you envision the or how do you envision the impact of the Fellows Program growing over the next 5 years? Where do you see it going?
Now, that's a really good question. We had our most recent retreat about a month or so ago in Baltimore, and we had a session where we talked about the future of the program. And what we heard over and over again is people truly appreciated meeting other individuals that were looking to do the work. You know, we have there's one individual that just finished up in our Gamma cohort who is a CFO at a retirement community. And he's very upfront about saying, like, look, I have my retirement date set. I don't, you know, it, and I don't, I know I don't have to do this work. He says, but I want to do it because it is necessary and it's something we must do in order to ensure future generations can really access our services and really feel welcome. You know, and so what I found over and over again is understanding that no matter what department, no matter what the level they are in the organization, you know, individuals can truly make an impact by starting that journey. And so for me, I think in looking forward to the future, it's really about continuing to grow those cohorts so that we can really have individuals that are in our space being able to proudly say, look, you know, we have a focus on inclusivity when it comes to our design or our outreach for residents or our marketing or our design of dining programs that are culturally competent. Knowing that every aspect of every community has to have, you know, an inclusion aspect of it. And that five-year plan really is looking, how do we grow ourselves? So there really is a universe of individuals that, you know, you aren't searching, ad nauseum for those partners, but they really are apparently there and they're willing to do the work.
Sure. So for someone listening who wants to get involved in the program, what's the first step?
Yeah, so they can visit us at wlawsoncompany.com, and right there at the top, they can click on a button that says Join the Movement, and they can find information about our Fellows Program. We actually are now in recruitment mode for our next cohort starting July 10th. And so individuals can put in an inquiry there. We also will be sending out information over LinkedIn this week for an informational session, what we call a check-in, that'll be on July 1st. And this may come out after that, but just noting that everyone can go to our website as well as finding information by downloading our program guide that gives everything everyone needs to know for our upcoming cohorts for the program.
Wonderful. Well, shifting to the Caregiver Action Network, which is another one of your initiatives, in your work with this network, what are the biggest needs you're hearing from family caregivers?
Yeah, that is a spectacular question, because when we talk about, you know, aging services, human services, you know, and understanding that this wide world that we live in, the backbone of everything we do are our family caregivers. The most recent survey or study put out by the RAND Corporation last fall estimates over 105 million family caregivers across the country. And just to define that, we're talking about in typically unpaid family caregivers. And family is chosen family. It can be the neighbor that's mowing the lawn because they notice that their neighbor of, you know, 10 years can't do it any longer. It could be the daughter that's long distance that's helping with a care planning meeting for their mom that's in a nursing home. It could be the son who, you know, has moved in with their sibling because their sibling has MS and needs support. The whole wide world of caregiving is growing and being better understood, I think, on a lot of different levels. Caregiver Action Network, which has been around for over 30 years, is a not-for-profit based in Washington, D.C. with a national reach. We have resources and support across all 50 states as well as internationally through our website and our help desk. I serve as CEO of the organization and have done so for the last 2 years or so, but it really is an extension of my lifelong commitment to supporting older adults and those that care for them. But one of the things we always underscore with Caregiver Action Network, we really are a not-for-profit providing no-cost resources to family caregivers and trying to meet them where they are. And so that can be anything from reaching out through us through our single point of entry help desk, which folks can either dial into, they can web chat, or they can email us just by going to caregiveraction.org, and as well as reviewing all of our resources, whether it's someone that has a loved one just getting a diagnosis with Alzheimer's disease and trying to navigate and understand what happens next, or for someone that is supporting a loved one that's going through another bout of cancer and another round of chemo, and how to not only take care of themselves as a caregiver, but perhaps understanding what the story is of other individuals out there. And so Caregiver Action Network is a really an amazing organization, one of the first ones to be established in this country that supports family caregivers, providing direct support to them. And we also are the catalyst behind each year's National Family Caregivers Month in November. And so we're really looking forward to that coming up as well. And just understanding that across this country and really across the world, you know, caregivers are just an impossible are a resource that you cannot replace, irreplaceable resource. And our objective at Caregiver Action Network is to really provide that resource to those caregivers so they know they're not alone.
Sure. And, you know, I've seen the stats where I think in 2030, we're going to have more people over 65 than we will under 18. And it's only going to, you know, create a continuing strain on the workforce. And having the family caregivers, I'm sure, are going to become increasingly important as the years go by.
Absolutely. And the thing is that, as we say, every caregiving situation is unique, even though there are themes that go across every situation. But, you know, what we find is people are many times kind of thrown into a caregiving situation. And I don't mean that in a malicious way, but that usually something happened. You get a phone call, you know, a parent or a loved one has fallen, they're in the emergency room, and all of a sudden you've got, you know, someone saying to you over the phone, hey, they're going to be leaving the hospital tomorrow, and this is where they're going to be going. And you have been thrown into a situation where, do I get on a plane? Do I try to get, you know, another loved one that's local to go there? Do I move there for a couple months? You know, it becomes a very exasperating experience. And what we try to do at Caregiver Action Network is be there for that caregiver right where they are. And so when someone reaches out to us, it could be that they're just having a bad day mentally, and we will talk with them. Our trained social workers will help them navigate whatever situation that may present to them. But understanding that, you know, each time that a caregiver engages with the loved one they're supporting, you know, they're giving of themselves. And we also recognize that you can't give from an empty cup. And so we also put a lot of our resources and energy into really advocating that caregivers have to take care of themselves. We use the metaphor, you're just like on a plane, you have to put your mask on before, you know, putting the mask on the person beside you, because you have to be able to have your own oxygen flowing to be able to help. And so when talking about the millions of caregivers across this country, really we come from a perspective of having resources that they're going to be valid and really helpful for them where they are right then and there, having information that allows them to go out and advocate for themselves, as well as understanding how to navigate the maze of healthcare and how to advocate with their doctors and care treatment team for their loved one. And also understanding that, you know, every situation is unique, and giving themselves the grace to understand that, like, there's no way that you're supposed to have this all figured out, you know, so please understand there are going to be tough days. There are going to be not so tough days. But, you know, as we plan for the future and understanding that caregivers are really the backbone of our healthcare system, the more support we can have for those healthcare, for those caregivers, the better we can have a really strong system for caring for older adults and, quite frankly, individuals across the age spectrum.
You know, that's such a fantastic analogy about, you know, putting the mask on the airplane before you help someone else, because, you know, I've talked with many caregivers who feel guilty when they express any concern for themselves, because they are, you know, I guess, largely selfless by providing this service, and don't want to feel like they themselves either are perhaps weak or can't do it, or you know, are being selfish. And you're right. I mean, they need. And what was the other one you said? You can't nourish from an empty cup.
You can't pour anything from an empty cup. If there's nothing to pour out, there's nothing to give. And, you know, I'm so glad you stated it that way, Derek, because, you know, we were just having a roundtable discussion this morning of caregivers of individuals with Alzheimer's and dementia. And one of the individuals whose parents are immigrants from India had said, you know, the other piece that's missing at times is understanding for care providers, healthcare providers, and anyone understanding, there's also a culture aspect of this, is that, you know, in the United States, we really do caregiving a bit differently. You know, it's not a given that someone is going to be in a multi-generational or intergenerational household, but that's so common in other countries. And so understanding that many times caregiving is not seen as something that is a role to play. Culturally, many times it's, well, I'm a daughter, I'm a son, you know, I'm not looking for resources because this is my responsibility. You know, this is on me to do this and figure it out. Or I don't want to air our dirty laundry outside of the family. You know, that's a very common thing amongst many cultures. And so you keep it close to the vest. But what that does is leaves the person really isolated and alone. And particularly when you're carrying those cultural norms, but you're in a situation where your community and your culture is not surrounding you. You know, you aren't perhaps the city or the town that your parents grew up in. And so you're in a place where that community doesn't exist as well as it could. And so there isn't that camaraderie that can perhaps hold up and support that caregiver or that care recipient. And so understanding that resources and being able to, quite frankly, bring together your chosen community is really one of the efforts that we really support at Caregiver Action Network, because that chosen family many times is going to be as strong or stronger than perhaps, you know, the family itself from blood. And so we try to point out with folks is that, you know, we've seen situations where a child comes out to their parents, comes out of the closet, is not met well with the conversation, and then leaves. But then there's a caregiving situation, and that child comes back into the family, maybe for the first time with a lot of baggage, but still showing up to help, you know, as much as they can, but then having to navigate all the emotions that they didn't deal with before they perhaps left the household. And so when we talk about caregiving, it's really not just about making sure the medication's given and they make it to the doctor's office. Unfortunately, there's a lot of emotion that's being dealt with and through that process. And so when we talk about self-care and supporting people's own mental health, it's really not just because, oh, you should be taking care of yourself. It's because, you know, if you burn yourself out, where do we go from here? You know, and really, how do you support your loved one best? And we find every single time is that it really is by supporting yourself as best as possible.
You're right, because ultimately it's the loved one that will be hurt if you are not able to provide that, and you can't provide it if you haven't taken care of yourself. So exactly. How can senior living providers and aging services organizations better support caregivers,
that
even
is
those outside their communities?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. I have to tell you that, you know, one of the things that I really advocate for when speaking with providers is that, you know, one of the things most communities have, you have space. So invite in the wider community of caregivers, because what you have right now in any senior living community, you odds are have 50 to 75% of the individuals there are doing some sort of caregiving role. You know, even if they didn't move in there with a partner or a spouse, you know, you still have that neighborly thing of like looking out for Mrs. Jones. I haven't seen her lately, and let me go check on her. That's caregiving. I picked up lunch, you know, and brought it over to Mrs. Smith because she, you know, has not been feeling well. That's caregiving. Helping someone live as independently and thrive as much as they can is caregiving. And so we say within, in my opinion, within senior living communities and providers, lean into that, because in my opinion, when you present yourself as a supporter of caregivers, those marketing prospects that present themselves and that are coming off of the list and showing up in your community, they're going to really understand like, oh, this is for me, because they get me. They get that I'm moving here maybe for my spouse. So they get that I'm moving here so I'm not a burden to their, you know, I put air quotes, burden to my kids. Understanding that caregiver infrastructure is really a way to talk with prospects and current residents and have them understand, look, we see you as a person, and we want to recognize the fact that every single day we know nonchalantly you probably are doing a dozen things that are helping the neighbors around you, you know, and for individuals that are receiving that support, it is immeasurable, because it may be that they're in their independent living unit a few months longer because of that support. It could be that they're able to make it to a musical or an activity off the campus because they have a neighbor that is willing to go along with them and making sure that you know, they get from A to Z or don't forget their purse or something like that. It's those small things in creating community that we see across the country that really, I think senior living communities already have, and being able to lean into that and open that up as a resource for the wider community, I think just really, it's kind of one of those things where high tide rises all boats. And in this case, I think senior living providers can really do a service to the wider community, whether it's bringing people in or doing it virtually. There's nothing to say that you can't have a Zoom every, you know, week or every month that's inviting in family caregivers that are long distance caregivers for people in your community and update them on what's going on, but also provide a space so they can talk to other individuals so they know, you know, you are one of 100 and something individuals across this country that are supporting individuals living in community X in Boca Raton, and you're not alone, you know, and to know that there's a community there that can support you, I think is the best thing we can do as senior living providers.
Lots of opportunities for wins in there. So what innovations or partnerships have you seen that are making a real difference for caregivers?
Oh gosh, that's a great question. So, you know, at Caregiver Action Network, we really pride ourselves on leaning into our partnerships. And so whether it's partnering with a company like Embodied Labs that provides virtual reality empathy-based training for caregivers to let them experience what their loved one may be going through, whether it's Alzheimer's, MS, autism, and having that point of view experience for them so they can really understand what their loved one may be experiencing. But also what we're finding over and over again is that our role is as a convener. And so we actually just launched a Caregiver Innovation Council where we've invited right now around 15 different companies that are startups that either are looking to support caregiving through innovation, or they may have a founder that has a caregiving journey that has really inspired them to do their work. And all this can be found at caregiveraction.org. But the Innovation Council is bringing together, you know, a little over a dozen companies to spend the next year talking and thinking about how can we innovate and really come up with collective solutions to help caregivers where they are. Because what we're finding over and over again is that individuals are just feeling alone and isolated as caregivers. And as I said before, you can Google anything, but you can be overwhelmed by the information you'll find out there. And so what we're finding is that there may be a standalone solution that can help someone with, let's say, monitoring or helping keeping tabs on their loved one if they're a long distance caregiver. Okay, that makes sense. But then, okay, how do you handle the medication management? That's another platform, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And how do you handle the doctor's visit? And that's another one. And so how do we really make this more holistic and cohesive, knowing that each new innovation that comes out that is standalone, it may make great sense as a company, but it's just another confusing aspect or layer for the caregiver. And so part of our journey with Caregiver Action Network is to really come alongside companies that are innovators in aging care tech and find ways to really make those solutions more accessible, make them more cohesive and synergistic. And so we can really see innovations take leaps and bounds in scalability across the country because, you know, caregiving, it's only going to become in more demand, quite frankly. There's not a downtick in caregiving that's going to be taking place. It's going to increase more. Nope. And unfortunately, because of the current climate we're in, where there is less monies that are going to be perhaps set dedicated to caregiving and to healthcare, it's going to be even more so dependent upon family caregivers to be supportive. And so we find that our ability to bring in innovation and support individuals with solutions perhaps might meet them where they are right now is a big part of how we're bringing innovative companies together.
Definitely. Now, are there any policies or programs that you think could dramatically improve the caregiver experience?
Gosh, yeah. You know, one of the biggest questions we get through our help desk at Caregiver Action Network is how do I get paid to be a caregiver? Because, you know, if you can imagine yourself, you're a son or a daughter of a loved one, and you have coordinated for someone to come into the home and support your loved one. So you're orienting them, you're telling them about their likes, their dislikes, all this other stuff. And then this, you know, this individual, rightfully so, is a paid caregiver coming into your home. But they'll never know your loved one as well as you do. And so in some states, you can be paid to be a caregiver through some Medicaid programs. I think California being one of them, you can be a paid caregiver and a relative of that person, because, you know, it makes just as much sense or if more sense than to pay someone in a home care agency. In other states where that perhaps is not the infrastructure, in some states you can work with the home care agency that may be looking to support your loved one and say, you know, can you train me to be that home care aide and pay me to support my mom? One, it helps with the staffing problems that most likely any organization is dealing with right now. And again, it provides that loved one with someone that knows them already. And so from my perspective, from a policy, an advocacy standpoint, we will always advocate for infrastructures to make caregiving pay, whether it's through tax credits or actual stipends for caregivers, or to make it easier for home care agencies to actually hire and compensate family caregivers to be able to support their loved ones where they are.
Wow. Interesting. Well, thank you for that. Now, I want to ask a question that we ask every Roundtable Talk guest. What are you looking forward to, Marvell, as you age?
Oh, wow. I don't think I've ever been asked that question before. And then you're talking to someone that was a nursing home administrator at the young age of 24. So I think it's continuing my momentum. You know, I think one of the things we really do a disservice to ourselves is thinking of older age as being this transition into this last hurrah. And I think we're really starting to find now and accept the fact, you know, by being, you know, as not as ageist as we have been previously, even though it's really the ism that still seems to be not so taboo, but understanding that the momentum I've gained through my career and through my family and through my life, that doesn't have to stop when I turn 65 or 70 or 80. If I decide to move into a community, it doesn't need to stop. And in fact, my momentum can really be something that is advantageous to the community around me for as long as I want to. And so for me, I look forward to being able to be in community with individuals for the remainder of my life. And to me, that means living intergenerationally. A few months ago, I came onto the Generations United board, which is a spectacular organization around intergenerational engagement, and just recognizing that, you know, caregivers and individuals across this country, whether you are 15 years old and you come home and you find out that your dad has early onset Alzheimer's and your after school has changed demonstrably, or if you are, you know, the sibling that has grown up alongside a loved one with a developmental disability and has supported them throughout their lives, you know, those commonalities really recognize that as we grow older, you know, this is really about giving people the opportunity to live as independently and thrive as best as they can. And the biggest thing I have hope for and look forward to is that, you know, each year that goes past, I see us being better and better at really allowing and embracing the norm that because you're aging does not mean your momentum slows down. And in fact, I'm looking forward to the fact that, you know, as I age, hopefully, I'll have less of a need to do the daily day-to-day 9-to-5, and I can have more room to do the things that perhaps may even give more back to the community even more than I do right now. And so I have a lot of hope for myself and my family as we age. And I'll say also, you know, the fact that 2035, all the kids will be off to college, that might be in the back of my mind as well, Derek.
Sure. Nothing wrong with that. And, you know, it's amazing when those life stages, you know, move on. So coming out of the pandemic, we heard a lot about, you know, societally of the great resignation. And you've spoken about it as well as the great retirement. How are these forces reshaping leadership in senior services?
Yeah, it is, you know, and it's a really interesting set of circumstances. And so, you know, we have known and seen for a while that the kind of the C-suite within aging services is aging, you know, many of them having been perhaps founders of their organizations, the first CEO or executive director of their community, and now they're reaching retirement or have decided to retire. I've seen this with a lot of my colleagues, you know, across the space, and recognizing that the pandemic exasperated that, it sped it up, you know. But what we also recognize is that almost in every instance I've seen, there has not been an internal candidate to promote into that role. And it doesn't mean that there always has to be, but what we're seeing over and over again is that we have not done all the work we need to do to prepare the next generations of leaders to really strive and thrive within aging services and lead the innovation that we need to solve some of the problems that have plagued us for so many years. And so from my perspective, I believe it's going to be critical that as the baton is passed, that we really do more to not only support mid-level and directors and managers in being able to grow and grow into those roles, but also recognizing that, you know, we don't have the depth of strength and abilities that we need to turn this next chapter to handle the number of retirements that perhaps are coming our way. So what does that provide us with is an opportunity to really think more innovatively and differently. And from my perspective, I think that really has to do with how can we, you know, as an industry, look at how we are creating our leaders and find ways to really look outside of our own kind of box and look into other areas, other industries, and how we can really create a much more formidable workforce that is ready to lead. Because I think the leaders are there in our organizations. It's just that they really need to be cross-pollinated. They need to be developed. They need to really see a career ladder that's going to be a trajectory that's going to be positive for them and rewarding for the organization. And so at the end of the day, I think it's really about being able to provide that keen ability and insight, knowing that, hey, if residents are saying to us, hey, we really want things different, we want different dining programs, we want different life experiences and activities, and we don't want it all within the confines of this campus, to be able to listen to that and recognize that, okay, maybe leadership can be different if we're thinking of our things programmatically differently, and also recognizing, you know, that retention is just the name of the game. We know right now that most of the organizations across this country where they're paid caregivers, CNAs, nurses, aides, dining services workers, odds are if they are good at their job, they could leave tomorrow and find another job someplace else if they so choose. And so being able to retain those individuals with high caliber benefits, a space that allows them to really bring their holistic self to work. And one of the things we do at Caregiver Action Network is we provide a turnkey caregiver resource group where we can work with employers to say, we can come in, provide support groups for your working caregivers, because we know a high percentage of individuals that are paid caregivers in our communities are also going home and are being unpaid caregivers for the loved ones as well. At the very least, they're providing advice to people in their family. And so how can you support those individuals so that they know this community has my back and they want me to be here for the long haul because they're showing me really that they support me and want to retain me. So we all know very well that the talent pool out there, is one that we're all dipping into. But at the end of the day, being able to kind of grow our own and understanding that the investment you put in your staff members today is an investment that pays off dividends in the future is just a really huge, important part of how we strategize for the future.
Indeed. So what is the long-term impact, in your estimation, of leadership turnover on the culture and continuity of aging services organizations?
I mean, I think the long-term impact is that we will be forced to figure things out in a way that we really haven't been pressured to do before. I don't see it as a bad thing necessarily. I think we'll find ourselves in positions where we're having to look outside of our industry for support and guidance and leadership. I think we're going to have to really think through how we do recruitments and the type of skill set we're looking for, because, you know, aging services is really human services, what we're talking about. And human services is really something that many of us connect to, you know, whether we're thinking about older adult population or not. And so how do we really encapsulate that in a value proposition that people that are great leaders out there in the field outside of aging can really see a reason to be drawn into our space, you know? So over time, I look to organizations out in the field that are doing innovative things like being more innovative about helping individuals gain citizenship in the United States and providing them a pathway to be legal citizens of the country so that they can stay and work and be a part of our infrastructure. You know, I'm seeing things out there of being able to invite in residents of different backgrounds, and demographics to hold space within communities so that they can understand this is an option that perhaps can work for you. But then also finding ways to support staff members, you know, beyond just the typical EAP, but really being able to say, you know, we want to develop a development plan with you on how you'll grow over the next few years, and not necessarily just for the needs of the organization, but for the needs of you as a human. And so I think it's nothing but opportunity that is there for the taking for our field. I think it's going to really take us to recognize that, you know, the answers that we need, I don't think we've found them yet. I think they're here, and I think we have the people around us to be able to figure it out. But it's going to take, I think, unfortunately, maybe a little bit more pain before we realize that, hey, you know, this is something we got to figure out, and we can't figure it out by just going back to the same old well over and over again. You know, the regulations will always be there. The oversight will be there. The trials and tribulations of being a provider won't necessarily go away. But I think the time is now for us to think more inclusively, and recognizing through that thinking, we can really be better organizations, because we're finding better people, because we're really broadening the tent of who can be a part of our organizations.
Well said. So how can communities better prepare for that leadership succession, especially when the successors are also nearing retirement?
Yeah. So, you know, what I humbly say to leaders is that, you know, get out of the way. And I mean that very, very sincerely, but also, you know, genderly, is saying that, you know, if you have a retirement date set, even just in your head, recognize that the literature would say that is not the time your organization is going to innovate. So if that's the case, and you recognize that your organization has to innovate in order to thrive and survive, particularly past your tenure there as their leader, start to identify leaders right now in your organization, and do the toughest thing for many CEOs to do, is seed power. Being able to say to an assistant administrator or a dining service director, hey, you know, this is a project I'd like you to lead. I know it's outside of your department. I know it may be something that you aren't used to, but we're going to get you, whether it's a coach, whether it's a mentorship, and really finding, you know, the ability to develop that individual. There are a whole cadre of programs out there through Leading Age and other providers, Argentum, that can really support that individual and their own growth, but also recognizing that at the end of the day, that leader has to decide, I'm going to cede some of my power to members of my team so that they can grow in a way, because what you're really doing is preparing the organization for you not being there. I think the fallacy that we think is that, oh, I'm preparing the organization for the next leader. I don't think that's what any outgoing CEO should be doing. You should be preparing the organization for when you aren't going to be there, because you won't have a hand, most likely, if the board's doing things how they should, in your successor. So preparing them for that unknown is not where your energy should be spent. You should be preparing and looking at, what growth and development do I need in my director of marketing? What growth and development do I need for my facilities director? And where do I see the weaknesses right now that I need to really strengthen so this organization has staying power? Because the thing that is going to be omnipresent is change. Change is going to keep happening. Uncertainty is just the way things are nowadays. And so preparing your organization for uncertainty and cheering your organization for change, I think, is one of the best things a CEO can do, particularly when they have their retirement date in mind, because that, one, gives your organization the opportunity to let leaders lean into their leadership opportunities more, and then be ready for that next change that's going to take place when a new leader comes in. Or you start to realize, well, wait a minute, I was talking to Susie Q down the hallway, and I think she is ready to step up. You know, maybe she could be a deputy director, or maybe she could be a number two for the incoming CEO, and we can get her ready for that role. But recognizing that there are resources out there, but at the end of the day, the person in the decision-making chair really does have to take the opportunity to cede some of their power and allow the organization to grow in ways that perhaps they hadn't envisioned previously.
Sure. Well, you mentioned boards. What role should boards play in building a more sustainable leadership pipeline?
That's a great question. You know, I think one of the key things that boards can do is really, as a part of the evaluation of their CEO, really say, is there a succession plan? And I don't mean just who you call if the you know, person goes out on FMLA, I mean, what is our real succession plan and how do we grow individuals? You know, it's one thing to say we have a recruiter that we're going to work with and we have, you know, individuals that are in the organization that may be interested in the role. But a succession plan is really a development plan for your leadership team. And how are you finding those individuals and knowing that you're really putting an opportunity out there for them to grow? So a couple different things I would say from a board perspective. One, making sure you hold your CEO accountable for that succession plan that includes growth and development for their team. And two, make the opportunity to have those moments where the board gets to know that senior leadership team perhaps a little bit better, maybe over dinner, maybe they go out, you know, and there's a barbecue where they come together, whatever that may look like. But giving the leadership team the opportunity to understand that that board is going to be there to support you and that CEO, you know, no matter what the next changes may take place. But the board does have an obligation to ensure the longevity and the ability of the organization to thrive. And I think the biggest way they can do that is really support the CEO in development plans for the leadership team and also recognizing that they can be a great resource for that leadership team as well.
You know, and it's, I mean, with all due respect, it's so basic, but yet it is so powerful. Build bridges, establish relationships. And that's going to be a way to actually be able to move forward together.
Yeah, it's really name in the game. And it's, I think for us, many times as an industry, we found ourselves really, being just the reactive industry, you know, so we react to change in Medicaid reimbursement, we react to changes in legislation, to regulations, all these things we react to. And you know, maybe we advocate the legislators and at Capitol Hill, but recognizing we're kind of getting this thing, you know, downhill, but recognizing that we do have control over how we support our team members. We do have control over our health and benefit plans, and we do have control over how we show up every single day. And so recognizing that retention and ability to grow people inside your organization is also a key way to really recruit and find new people coming in, because they'll see they'll feel the love of the organization, you know, from the very start of it. And so, you know, I just really advocate for the fact that many times the simplest route is if you're uncertain of how to support your team, ask them. And if they aren't, and if your immediate reaction is, well, they won't tell me, you got something to figure out then why your staff won't tell you. And that's another step. It doesn't mean you stop. It means you have to figure out what it is it's going to get through. And for some organizations, that's sometimes bringing in a third party facilitator to say, hey, we really do want to know. We really want to find out about our organization. But there's great companies out there that are doing really good work around employee engagement and employee satisfaction. And so we're not without resources, certainly in our industry. And so being able to find those resources and bring them to bear is really a big part of how we solve some of these problems.
Sure, sure. So shifting gears to inclusion, we've seen a dramatic change in how organizations are approaching DEI and their commitment to its principles. What are your thoughts on that, and how is that shift impacting the work that you do?
Yeah. So it's been interesting to see, because I think there's been, some hesitation or uncertainty that's been inserted for some individuals. But what I still see in particularly in senior living and aging services is that we really are still just starting to get our sea legs around DEI and how we embrace that. And so we're kind of in this in-between place. I think there's been some hesitation that's been allowed by leaders that are really maybe not bought in on the front end of it or understanding the value that it can bring. But I think on the whole, we really are moving in a positive direction. One, I think because our teams throughout the organization are becoming more diverse, because the demographics around where we recruit and our primary market areas are becoming more diverse. I was talking with a client up in the Massachusetts area, and they did looked at the census projections for, you know, their PMA, and they found that, you know, in 20 years, the it's going to explode the number of Latin and Hispanic individuals living in that area. And so even if they thought to themselves, okay, well, you know, is does that culture going to want to move into our community? How do we prepare for that? That's one aspect of it. But also, are you preparing for having a workforce that perhaps is more diverse than you had previously? Are you preparing for the fact that you may need to help individuals become legal citizens, that you may need to help individuals with English as a second language? There are things that we really have to now ask ourselves that are we willing to do in order to really bring talent into the community? Because when I think of someone that may be an immigrant to the United States, many times those individuals have done roles that are far and above the skill set that they're being asked to utilize here in the States. And so many times you're finding someone that has a skill set that you would kill to have as a CNA or as a nurse on your team. So embracing that and finding ways, not just to find ways that it's not going to work, but working with an individual and figuring out what are the barriers to you being successful in our organization and help them reduce those barriers. Because each time you have that success story and retain that individual, look, the best thing the thing that I loved the most when I was in community and meeting with new orientees, I would ask, and it was a bellwether for me to be able to know when a majority of the people are at an organization through orientation because they knew somebody working there already. That was always success for me. You know, I really loathed if somebody said they found us on Indeed or on a website where it's like, that's fine. But it's like, that's not what I want. I want someone to come here because they want to be here because they've heard from a friend or a family member that it's a great place to work. And you do that by investing in the individuals you currently have and making sure that they're held up. And so at the end of the day, when we're talking about inclusion, it's not just about diversity for diversity's sake. It's recognizing that the world around us is changing, and it's changing very rapidly. One of the statistics I share with folks is that, you know, by 2040, the number of individuals that are over the that are 65 and above, you know, the biggest growth that's going to take place is amongst Black, Indigenous, and people of color. That's where the most growth will take place. Then when you start to get to 2040, 2050 and beyond, you really start to see a snowball effect. And that if you're caught flat footed, you're going to find yourself really without the prospects. That waiting list will start to dry up because, you know, it's not just about an individual thinking to themselves, I want to live in a more diverse environment. That's one aspect of it. But thinking about the fact that Gen X, millennials and Gen Z are going to be influencers of the decision-making of those older adults. And they aren't going to want to advocate for that person to move to a community that's segregated or that perhaps isn't as diverse. And so you're talking about an audience that is changing greatly. And you're talking about a universe where the information is out there. And so you can have, you know, a 20-something-year-old grandson in Boise, Idaho, that's helping their grandma figure out a place in New York State and saying, you know, Grandma, I don't think you want to go there. It's not very New York City, like in the sense of adversity. That's a very, you know, expected conversation to have. And so when that influence takes place, you're really talking about how can we be in a better position to meet people where they are and recognize that the sphere of influence is really changing greatly. And it's not just that couple that walked in and, you know, as an intake, and now you can, you know, perhaps show them a two bedroom apartment. It's really about the whole cadre of individuals that are trying to help that person make the decision. And most likely trying to have them be in an environment that's intergenerational, that has a lot of cultural diversity to it, that has a welcoming environment for the LGBTQ environment, but also has a staff and support team that is diverse and culturally competent so that they can feel supported and safe in their environment.
Sure, sure. Now, you've said that longevity is inextricably tied to inclusion. Can you break down what that means in practical terms?
Yeah. Thank you for asking that. So what I mean by that is when you look at just the sense of longevity across the globe, so you can talk about blue zones, you can talk about, you know, people are living longer in the United States and across the globe. This goes across cultures. And so if we're talking about living longer, living more healthy, and we're seeing the examples of longevity be in different cultures across the globe, to not think to us, it would be really foolish of us to think that we can do that and still remain as silo as we are when it comes to inclusivity. And so if we are going to live longer and thrive. I think it really is an absolute that inclusion is a part of the equation because we're changing as a country so dramatically. And not to mention that, you know, as that longevity takes hold, you're also talking about individuals that are of younger generations engaging with individuals of older generations more readily. And so that, again, brings to it another facet of diversity and inclusion. Whether it's income diversity, gender, sexuality, nationality, race, political affiliation, I mean, you name it, religion, there are so many different facets of diversity that we could be looking at, you know, when it comes to a community level as well as a systemic level. And so from my perspective, I think being able to embrace that and recognize that the longer we live, the more influence there will be on our paths of life. And that inextricably is tied to inclusion because the lessons that we're learning are coming from a spectrum of cultures across the globe that we are embracing, and we want to see that. And so not to to embrace the cultures of which we're learning from, I think, is really a misstep for us, but also to recognize that we right now have an industry within senior living that is highly dependent upon various cultures and backgrounds in order to get our day-to-day work done. And so if you aren't being inclusive, the ability of an organization to really embrace longevity is really put in peril.
So what does inclusion look like in action beyond policies and statements and those sorts of things?
Yeah. So, you know, what I usually talk about is that when you're talking about in a community being inclusive, you really are talking about how an individual feels when they come into your organization. And I give this metaphor is that, you know, everybody has planned probably a birthday party, maybe for a loved one, maybe a kid's birthday party, whatever. You know, everybody, you know, listening to this has probably had a marketing event they planned. We all, and so you send out the invitations, you get the list, all this other stuff. But if people show up and there's no wayfinding signs where the event's going to take place, there's no greeter at the front door, there's no one helping them get to their seat, those other stuff, you've essentially planned a party without planning the welcoming part of it. And that's where we fall down on. And so for me, inclusion is really about planning the welcome party. And how do you plan the welcome party? You get to know the people that are coming into your community. So to say to, you know, a community to say, hey, we need a more diverse resident base here, and let's start advertising in different aspects, you know, different trade magazines, different parts of the country. Okay, good luck. But have you really done the work that when they show up, that they feel welcomed? And if they don't, well, then they're probably not going to move in or they're not going to stay there. And so to me, inclusion is about planning that welcoming party and ensuring that everyone is feeling that they are not only welcome to the community, but they actually belong there, because that's where you get the stickiness of that person saying, you know, hey, I moved into this place, you know, outside of Washington, D.C., and I can't tell you, I feel so at home. I mean, look at the wonderful stories you see of the Pride up in Massachusetts and other LGBTQ centered or focused communities across the country. You've seen communities like I think down in the shores in Georgia that are focusing on a Korean or Asian centric community because of the population there that's burgeoning. You see the same thing out west. So we really do understand how to do it, but I think one of the things that's missing is recognizing that as you're talking about bringing together diverse populations, you have to educate yourself in a way that this party's got to work for everybody. So maybe you got to have, you know, a quiet space for them to be able to not be amongst all the noise that's going on. You got to perhaps have a better explanation. You got to have maybe some closed captioning, whatever it may be. But being able to recognize that if you're going to invite in diverse populations, you have to really be ready to welcome them in a way acknowledging that sense of belonging.
That's great. Well, before we shift to our last subject, I had the question here, but you've kind of already answered it, but I want to just see if there are any other buttons you want to put on it. But what's your advice to communities that want to attract a more diverse resident population but aren't seeing results? I know you said, you know, plan the welcome party. Mm-hmm. And I love what you've been saying, but if they're doing that and aren't seeing results, what else can they do, or what advice would you have for them?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the first things that has to happen is for a community to, one, really define for them what that diversity looks like, because it can be different for everyone. I would say that if you are in a part of the country that the demographics are 90%, you know, one ethnicity or nationality, that the demographics, you know, aren't as diverse in that primary market area, you know, there may be some limitations to what is possible for some of the more outwardly seen parts of diversity that we talk about. But that doesn't mean that you don't have diversity in religion and income and culture and background. And so what I say to folks is that what is it that you want to accomplish? And first, let's recognize the diversity already exists, because I don't care what community you are, you have diversity there already. It's just that it doesn't feel like diversity, perhaps, because you're all in it and you're used to it. But recognizing what those differences are and how you've embraced those. Second, I would say to folks is being able to look in the wider community and ask the wider community that is most likely becoming more diverse, what is it that you can be, how you can be a part of that diversity? And if you can find a way for whether it's your auditorium to be used once a month for a sorority, a fraternity to come together and bring people in, whether it's, you know, an event for caregivers to be able to come together for a support group, you want to invite people in to see that you are making effort and you're doing the work to be more inclusive. And as they feel that, they have a more sense of belonging, and it allows them to say, okay, you know, this no place is going to be perfect, but if I'm looking to move someplace, I'm going to consider the place that invited me to come in and bring in my group of friends from my sorority, and really were great and worked with us so well. And they really seemed to understand, you know, this lifelong commitment and my sisterhood or my brotherhood. That's really where the rubber meets the road. But, you know, what lastly I'll say to folks is recognizing that it has to be something that is pervasive. So for you to just look at just resident diversity, that can be a start. But you need to look at your boards. You need to look at your senior leadership. You need to look at all aspects of it. And, you know, many times folks will say, well, our board, we've tried to have more diverse boards, but, you know, it's just kind of where we are, you know, in this part of the country. And you say to them, well, you know, you certainly didn't come together as a board during the pandemic. You were on Zoom. Many of the boards have stayed on Zoom because it's easier. What's to stop you to recruit somebody from different parts of the country that may have bring a diversity of thought or diversity of background that you haven't seen already? And I get that it's important to have individuals that are local. You want to have local leaders. You want to have local influencers. But hey, there's nothing to stop someone from having someone from Long Beach, California, be on their board. Just even if they're a provider in South Carolina, just as it's no different as someone having someone on the South side of Chicago, you know, if they are, you know, from Cleveland. That ability exists there, but it does take intentionality and come up with a plan to be able to figure out how do we recruit from the board to the C-suite to managers to direct care staff to ensure that that pipeline is a strong one and that we're recognizing that this diversity is a strength for our organization.
Sure, sure. Thank you for that. Now you've described a trend called the Great Rejection, where boomers, despite being age and income qualified, are opting out of traditional senior living in overwhelming numbers. What's driving this shift, and how should the field respond?
You know, it's one of the things that I think we all see is that the way I usually put it is you send out 100 invitations to the age and income qualified list. Of those 100, maybe you get 20 or so, maybe even 30 that will seriously consider you. Of those 20 or 30, maybe you get 10 of those that deposit, and of those 10, you get 8 or 7 that move in. So 7 to 8 people out of that 100. And it's not as if those other 93 people are moving to some other community. 90% of them are staying home. And we all know that that is the biggest competitor to senior living communities in residence. And so what I say to folks is that consider a few different things. One, if 90% of your age and income qualified market are staying home and you aren't considering some sort of at-home offshoot of your community, you're missing an opportunity. If 90% of the individuals that are age and income qualified are staying at home and you aren't finding ways to bring them in to programmatically integrate them into the community while they stay at home, I think you really are missing the boat. And so from my perspective, it really is about recognizing the market is changing in a way that I believe there's a rejection of our sense of, you know, of some that you still segregate old people behind a set of gates on a campus because that's what they want. But I think the nowadays and going forward, that siloing or segregation is not what people are looking for. I mean, right now in the neighborhood I live in, and I would guarantee to say, Derek, the neighborhood you live in, are not all the people that are of your same age. You know, that's not a requirement to live in the cul-de-sac. And so asking people to move into a community that makes that the requirement, even if you're talking regulatory sense that it has to be that way, there are ways you can do it differently. A program that we started at one of the communities I served when I was with Kendall, we started an artist in residence program where we had every year two students that were living with us that were from the School of Music, a doctoral level School of Music students from the University of Maryland. And it infused such an energy that was so palpable, but it was such a simple thing. You know, and what it says to prospects coming in, as well as family members, that this organization is about bringing life into the organization, not keeping life at the other end of the bus route, you know, because that's how we think of it many times. Get up, well, we'll get on the bus and we'll go see the life. We'll go see the prop, the plays and the opera. We'll go. But how do we bring that into and bring, you know, a concert for the community into your own space? How do you bring, you know, a musical or some sort of ability to bring in the wider community and that inclusion in? And so I think the answers are there in front of us, but a part of it is really recognizing that we no longer should consider ourselves this siloed portion of the system of care, but really an integrated part of the community that we serve.
Sure, sure. So how can sales and marketing teams pivot to better connect with today's more selective older adults?
That's a great question. You know, I would put it to you this way, is that I think sales and marketing, you know, everyone's seen that it's a much longer time frame to close a lead. You know, it used to be 6 months, 12 months, maybe. Now you're talking 2-3 years to close a lead, you know, and that over time is really about relationship building and relationship maintenance. And in my opinion, that means not just connecting back with Susie Q because, you know, the CRM told you it was time to call her. It's about saying, you know, understanding their circle of friends, their circle of influence, and inviting those influencers into your world. You know, being able to recognize that, hey, Mrs. Jones, who's been looking at us for a couple of years, is going to come and do an overnight stay with us. We'd like to set up a dinner and have her invite her daughter and have her invite someone else with us as well, you know, to be a part of that. Expand the realm of influence, and so that you recognize that, hey, you know, this person is the final decision maker who's your prospect, but you as a sales counselor, you have the opportunity to go out and meet with these cohorts where they are and have a recognition that, you know, and it doesn't need to be superficial. If you're interested in pickleball, God bless you. Go out and play. Don't just play pickleball at your community. Play pickleball in the places where you want to get residents to consider you. Go to the gym membership and like think of your own interests as being a gateway to sincerely reaching out to individuals. And that sincerity is really what drives people in. And so for those sales and marketing folks, I always implore them, use what you have. And if you have a passion about something, utilize that passion to find ways to connect with networks of older adults, because 9 times out of 10, that passion is going to make that sale. You know, they'll figure out what unit, they'll figure out the entry fee, all that stuff will come. But getting that person to actually engage in knowing that Johnny Smith, who's their sales counselor, has more of a connection than just the fact that he checks in with them every 3 months is huge. And it's going to make them feel safe. It's going to make them feel welcome. And it's going to give them a pathway to join the community that perhaps they don't see someplace else.
Sure, sure. Great advice. Well, Marvell, this has been just a true pleasure. I've got one last question I'd like to ask you. I could talk all afternoon with you. But this one final question is, what have you learned that you wish you could have told your younger self?
What have I learned that I wish I could have told my younger self? That's a great question. You know, I would say that it's at the end of the day, that it's always going to be about creating a space to bring people together. And that that doesn't always mean that you're the leader to do that. You know, recognizing that there are strengths on your team and within your organization that really can spread your ability to bring people in, I think is something we miss a lot. There could be someone that's working in the laundry that could be a great connection to a senior center down the street. There could be someone that is an activities aide or director that in their church, if they were given the opportunity and some resources, that they could really, you know, have a dozen more people on your waiting list by the end of the next month. And so recognizing that your strengths are throughout your organization and being able to find ways to tap into those strengths and let your team members know that you want them to lean in. You know, I think it's something if I'd have learned that sooner, you know, I would have had an even more rewarding career of helping people grow, you know, and develop themselves.
I love that. Well, Marvell Adams Jr., thank you so much. Really appreciate your time, generosity with your insights and, you know, everything that you provide and do for our field.
Thank you so much, Jared. Thanks for having me. I love your program.
Good. Well, thank you. And thanks also to Dave Schaffner, our producer, and Matt Campbell, our engineer. I'm Derek Dunham, and we'll see you next time on Varsity's Roundtable Talk. I'm talking with you on the next episode of Roundtable Talk.